What was he wearing?
Well, he predicts, he was wearing a red Argyle sweater and tan trousers and red shoes.
Hmm?
No, he's not retarded.
Hello and welcome to another Surviving Grady podcast. My name is Red. His name is Denton. And we are also happy to have with us tonight a very special guest, our good friend and blogger, blogass, whatever the nomenclature is, extraordinaire. Beth is with us from cursed2first.com. That's cursed, T-O, first.com. Beth, thank you very much for lying to your friends about what you're doing tonight and actually joining us.
Thank you guys for having me. I'm so happy you guys invited me to do this.
It's very much appreciated. Beth is the first guest we've had on a podcast, actually the first person who would actually agree to doing anything with us, even remotely. A podcast is just, it's tough to get people to do anything with us, let alone a podcast, but Beth will always have a very special place in our hearts, as she was the very first blogger to give Surviving Grady a link back in 2004, and we're forever grateful for that. Also, she once co-signed an auto loan for Denton when he was fresh out of rehab and trying to get back on his feet, so we're forever grateful for that.
Have you approached her about the puppet skit yet?
No, no, we don't mention puppets till the last 5 minutes.
Sorry.
Wait till we lull them into a false sense of security with some actual questions, then we'll spring the puppet stuff on her. But
And you guys owe me that bail money from that one time. Don't leave that.
Well, that's that. Now we'll have to edit that out now because.
Oh, what you can okay.
Denton.
That's about the other thing, but not that.
You're right. Well, we'll everything's on the table here. We have no secrets. For the next 15 minutes, our job is to entertain you and talk Red Sox, and hopefully the three of us will not let you down. Denton, how are you doing this fine evening?
Fine, sir. Fine. Very good.
Excellent.
Ready to go.
All right. Well, since we have a guest here, we're going to forego the usual bullshit and make it look like a respectable podcast. So we'll start with a few questions, concepts, things we can kick around a bit. And the first thing, this is something that's been troubling me for the last week or so, whenever the hell they basically came out with, you know, the quote-unquote official theories as to who is going to be winning the World Series. Everyone's picking the Red Sox. They're talking Red Sox, Phillies in the World Series. It's you know, growing up in this environment and seeing, you know, basically having our asses handed us to every October. It's an interesting dynamic to now find ourselves being picked. It's understandable, but it's also interesting. But my question is, and I'll ask this of Beth first, do you think it's tougher going into the season as the favorite instead of the underdog? I think of the 2004 playoffs and how, according to our old friend Kevin Millar, we shocked the world, we're going to shock the world. But I wonder, is it better to be the team that shocks the world and wins it all when everyone assumes you're just going to fall on your ass? Or is it better to be the team that everyone assumes is going to win? Or does it even matter, you think, in the long run?
I think it's two different. There are two different answers. I think the players on the field really don't give a crap, but from a superstitious fan perspective, absolutely. I still just get this knee jerk thought of just jinx when I hear all that talk. I mean, I know scientifically, okay, it makes no difference whether you say out loud that a guy's got a no hitter going, right? But I'd still cringe if somebody did it. So, talking about the World Series in February feels the same way.
That's a good point.
You know, also for a fan, when you get your expectations built up, you know, it can be more of a crushing disappointment than you start from nothing. And I don't know, I'm a little tired of that, actually, since we're not exactly championship-starved around here anymore. But it would be disappointing as hell to see them go for broke and not make it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I do agree with you there. I think that I would wager that, you know, as my dad used to say, Tim, those players are going home to their teenage wives and their mansions, and you're sitting here driving nails through your heart. Why do you do it? They, you know, I think you're right. They probably, you know, I'm sure they're at the stage where they can leave it on the field and not have to carry it around with them like the rest of us. What do you think, Denton?
Well, I think it's a matter of the players themselves. The fans are going to expect too much no matter what with all the off-season moves, but I think it's up to how the players handle it. And I don't see these guys really giving a shit one way or the other what people think. Guys like Pedroia will probably welcome, you know, the attention of being the favorite. But The second part of it is, I think, with a guy like Francona there to kind of manage the egos as well as he does, I think he's going to keep them all level-headed and just focused on, you know, playing their game. And as dry as his kind of post-game speeches are, I think they're true. He just keeps them focused on playing a good game that night and worry about the next game the next night. And I don't think all this media hype about 100 games and World Series with Philly is really going to make any difference to the team themselves.
They've been selected and bred for this environment, you know? I mean, think about how many homegrown guys we have now on the team, and it's like a eugenics experiment. Like, they've, you know, they've selected the personalities, even, you know, to cope with the environment. It's true.
It is interesting. It is an interesting kind of, like, a pedigree, people who fit the mold, and... But I kind of share the opinion that both of you have. I do think that the players are probably immune to that stuff. I mean, they have to be. I mean, if you're going to be, I mean, I think you have to, when you're a professional baseball player and you spend most of your time, say, out in the field, with 3,000 drunk guys named Sully screaming at you, then I think you've kind of reached a point where, you know, you block out the outside and all that. It just becomes white noise at some point, I assume. So, I agree. I certainly invite it. I think it's pretty awesome. And what a difference it is, having grown up with such shit-kicking teams. But it's nice. It's a nice place. It's a nice place to be. What am I, a Yankees fan? I'm not going to complain about it. All right, moving on. Our old friend Josh Beckett. Josh Beckett, as we all know, in 2007 was like fucking lightning in a bottle. He was he was 20 and was he 20 and 6, 20 and 7, 20 and 7, I think he was, and 27. Beth is the is basically the Josh Beckett encyclopedia in convenient human form, just rattling this stuff off.
This is just going to be the end of me. I officially cannot run for public office after talking about Josh Beckett with you guys.
But he last year he went 6-6 and he started only 21 games, which was the fewest games he'd started since I think his first full season of service back when he was with Florida. But is it possible? I mean, everyone says, you know, not to put any more pressure on the guy, but everyone says, well, he, you know, we know Lester and Buchholz are going to give you this, and hopefully Lackey will have his one season to settle down in the AL East, and he'll be back, and no one really gives a shit about Matsuzaka, because I assume he's going to be traded or be taken out sometime before the season actually starts. But as far as Beckett goes, and Denton, I'll ask you this first. What do you think? Is it possible for him to bounce? I mean, obviously, he needs to come back from a 6-6 season. There were some injuries. What are you anticipating for Josh Beckett in 2011?
I think he's going to have a great year. I think he was probably more injured than anyone knew last year. If you look back, he has that weird odd year, even year thing going, which makes no sense whatsoever. But it is an odd year, so I really think he's going to be fine. He went 20-7 in 2007, 12-10 in 2008, 17-6 with an under 4 ERA in 09, and then the horrible year last year. But I really got to think he was more injured than he was saying or anyone was saying, and he's going to bounce back strong this year.
And Beth, you're obviously sending him the positive vibes.
Actually, this might surprise you, but as much as my heart wants to say yes, because, you know, I mean, nothing would make me happier than a return of the 07 Beckett, and I think anybody who's, you know, known me for 5 minutes knows that. But, you know, in my head, the jury's still out, because earlier last year, I was trying to make a point with somebody about Daisuke at the time, so I was looking at Lester and Beckett's numbers compared to them. And I was surprised at how Beckett's numbers really were kind of meeting in the middle with Lester's. I expected his to still be higher than Lester's, but they were also headed in opposite directions over time. So, and then Beckett went and laid a total egg last year. So, the thing that really worries me, I guess it's twofold. One is that, it seems like all it takes is one little thing wrong with Beckett for his whole game to go completely off kilter, especially as he's gotten older. And, you know, he gets these weird injuries like blisters, he pulls an oblique, and then he's just completely just mechanically shot, you know? When he flames out real hard. He's not a horse like, you know, Schilling is, mm-hmm. was, or, you know, as far as like just, you know, pitching on one leg. But he's, you know, he's also, he's not a lot older in years than the other starters in the rotation. Like you mentioned, he was 27 in 2007, and most guys get called up like 25, 26. But in terms of time in the bigs, he's actually been in the majors since he was 21. And if you're the MVP of the World Series at age 23, and if one of the things you do to accomplish that is pitch a complete game to clinch the World Series on the road on 3 days rest at Yankee Stadium, you've had more quote-unquote pressure pitches on your arm, let's say, than most 30 to 31-year-old pitchers I can think of. So I just I don't know how many bullets he necessarily has left. And I do hope he makes me look like a total jackass.
I think the thing that made his triumphs in the 2003 World Series against the Yankees was the fact that, you know, in Game 7 he was hungover. I mean, I just have that feeling. I'm watching him, and it was an amazing performance. And, of course, at that point we were all still, no one was really over the ALCS at that point, but I just remember saying, I just really want to see this guy kick their ass from one end of town to the other. And it was, you know, that alone, I mean, obviously when he came to our team, it was the icing on the cake, but he was forever enshrined in my heart after that performance in 2003. But I hope the same thing. I mean, I like the guy, and I like the persona, and maybe if the persona is something that we, you know, I other people read too much into. I mean, you like to portray him as this kind of grumpy, evil, not caring sort of guy. I'll never forget the time he called out Heidi Watney. I don't know what the hell he was all about. He was pissed off that she asked we've already asked that question, Heidi, which of course was the result of some lover's spat gone wrong. You know, there was something there that we don't know the full story about. But I can't imagine he could do any worse than he did last year if he remains healthy. And as Denton said, he does kind of have that odd year, even year, kind of like the Star Trek movies. Was it the odd ones were good and the even ones? I don't know. Whatever. What was Star Trek 2? That was the good one, right? All right. So the even Star Treks were good, but Beckett seems to be going against that. He's the odd years he's doing good. So if Denton's prediction is anything, if he was good in 2009 and not so good in 2010, then 2011, we're guessing, would have to be good. Now, of course,
you know, I thought my odd year, even year was pretty scientific, and then Beth comes in and starts talking about how many pressure pitches the guy had thrown, and I feel like an asshole.
I expect a restraining order to show up on my doorstep any day now. So,
well, I was going
to
ask you if they, when they were doing contract renegotiations, and they said, "Hey, can we get someone around here to follow Beckett around? Who would be first?"
Like Crawford, I would have been your girl for that, but yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's it. There was an infamous, I don't want to go off too far off track here, but there was also an infamous, who was the guy? Was it Rick Cerrone back in the day? They were following him. Oh, no, it was Jim Leyritz. Somebody who we had, they were following him. Because remember there was that big story, they let him go, and they said, oh, he was wandering around town. He was buying masks at Jack's Joke Shop in Waltham or something like that. There was someone was being followed. Even back in the day, they were following players around. Did I dream that? That actually happened.
I was just going to say, I think that was it.
I could swear there was a story. Someone was tailing Jim Leyritz when he was with us, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm wrong. Well, we don't quite know what we can expect from Josh Beckett, but I think we do know what we can expect from John Lester and Clay Buchholz, and I would imagine it's more of the same, more serious ass-kickage. I mean, last year, between the two of them, they won 36 games there. I mean, it's the very fact that we could have those two guys and the thought of a healthy, recharged Beckett and a respectable John Lackey is almost too much to fathom. So you hope that everything comes together and gels. But, I mean, outside of these guys, you know, wearing jetpacks at every game or, you know, acquiring the power of flight or the ability to shoot lightning bolts through their fingers, can we really expect anything more from these guys? I mean, if they just have a year somewhat similar, I can't – you like – they could very well get better. I mean, Lester is very much in his prime. Clay, I mean, it's amazing to think they could be even better, but can we really expect much more from them? I mean, if they pulled this similar to what they did last year, this year, then, you know, the battle is won.
All right, who do you want to go first?
Let's hear from you, Beth, because, you know, I get a...
The pitching queen.
Anything to get you off the Josh Beckett kick, you know, we're nervous. You know?
I know, so is he, probably. So, you know, actually, I was thinking about this because My knee-jerk thought was that, you know, Lester is a little inconsistent, especially early in the season. I would hope for him to come out, you know, kind of guns blazing more this year. But I looked at his numbers, and, you know, all Lester didn't do last year that Beckett did in 2007 when he came in second for the Cy Young was win 20 games. And otherwise, actually, all of Lester's numbers are actually better than Beckett's in 2007 for 2010. From how many starts he made, to how many innings he pitched, to how many strikeouts per nine innings. You know, he's got some more ceiling, I guess, if you're talking about him matching Pedro in 99. So I guess it's theoretically possible he could do better. And I'm really curious to see, you know, really what he's going to be. Because I know that he's been a, you know, his stock has been high as a prospect forever. And like you said, he's still young. His numbers just seem to be going up every year. So I think what we can reasonably hope for with him is just more of the same. And I think it would be kind of greedy to expect more. But Clay was one of our most consistent pitchers last year in the MASH unit that was our team. But that's not saying much, you know. And he hasn't hit 200 innings in a season yet, actually. Last year he pitched like something like 175 and change.
Right.
And, you know, his other numbers are still kind of middle of the road. And he's also even younger. I don't think he's whatever they talk about filled out yet the way they do around, you know, 25 and later.
I'm still waiting for me to happen to me as well, so I can understand where he's coming from.
Well, but I mean, Lester was a real beanpole when he first came up, you know,
right,
and now
right.
You know, he's been Beckettized, but
you know, beeritized.
I hope Clay will keep getting stronger because I think, you know, he's been untouchable as far as trade bait and everything with Theo, but I think it's starting to be do or die time for him to show something really special.
I agree, and I think that it was interesting because he was one of those guys, and there were many times that his name came up in a trade, and you kept thinking, why won't they part with this guy? What is the thing? And then last year, you know, he goes 17-7, so you say, okay. So you see it start to gel, like, oh, they do see something. They saw something that we didn't quite see, so you do sort of hope for the same thing. I like watching him pitch. I miss the one thing I could say about Pedro is it was watching him pitch was an event, as Denton will tell you. I mean, Denton, we'd literally print up the K's in the fucking house, plastering K's on the wall and shit. When it was an event when he pitched, much in the same way it was when Clemens used to pitch. And you missed that when Pedro was gone. You kind of missed the idea of the event pitcher that, you know, when he was on the mound, he was just amazing to watch. And you were spellbound just watching him fool batters and the way he would control a game and just sort of just run everything off the mound. And it's nice to see that in Lester. It's nice to see it in all of these young pitchers. It's quite amazing. Denton, I don't know if there's any analogy here for odd or even years with these two guys.
I got nothing, but I do have to go on a tangent about the Pedro event thing. I remember going over to Casa Red one day to watch, I think it was a day game actually, a weekend game, but my daughters were still little at the time, and I brought them along, and we're all hanging out watching the game, and you had a little stuffed Pedro guy sitting on top of the TV, and one of my little daughters ambled over there and tried to grab it and knocked it over, and I thought you were going to throw her out the window. She still remembers it to this day. She was like 5 years old, and she knocked over the Pedro doll, and you thought it was going to make it lose the game. So
that's why she doesn't talk to me anymore.
That's one of the reasons. Yeah. But getting back to Lester, I actually think from a stats perspective, if he does what he did last year, he could win 23 games this year because he lost a lot of ball-breaking games last year or didn't get a decision for them. He had a six-inning outing against Cleveland. Colorado. He went six, gave up a run. They lost the game 2-1. There was a bunch of those, you know, no offense games last year that I don't see happening with the lineup they're going to be putting on the field this year. So I wouldn't be surprised to see him 22-23 game winner this year. Buchholz, to Beth's point and to your point as well, he hasn't pitched a number of innings yet. He's a real small guy like Pedro was. It's going to be interesting to see how he holds up if he can get in 30 starts and and go, you know, six innings per start. But if he can hold up like that and pitch as well as he did last year, these guys are just great to watch, like you said.
I hate to bring up the evil empire at this point, but it's interesting. You see this talk of the Red Sox being predicted to win the World Series, the AL East. You've got the Yankees. You get Mark Teixeira saying, "Well, we're happy to be the underdogs." But I find a far more. I'm sorry. What were you going to say?
No, I was just laughing at that.
I find a far more interesting. In addition to all this, the far more interesting story I think with the Yankees is this Brian Cashman seeming to lose his shit a little bit more every day. Basically, you know, at the press conference to introduce Soriano, basically saying he didn't want to sign him. He's sitting next to the guy and basically saying he didn't really want to sign him, and you know, and referencing, you know, mentioning CC Sabathia's weight, and it's been nothing but good stuff. If anything, he's been a great source of entertainment. Why the fuck I haven't been doing more of the Cashman headwoman dialogues with this comedy gold? You don't need to anymore. He's doing it himself. He's bringing the comedy. But I guess my question is twofold, and I'll ask you this, Beth. First of all, do you think Cashman's basically just counting the days and looking to get out of there? But more importantly, do you agree that I think there's always a danger in discounting the Yankees? I've probably attended more Yankees elimination parties than I care to remember, and it's always come back to bite me in the ass, which made 2004 so remarkable. But I think there's always a danger in we like to do it. We're all guilty of it, but I think we do it at our peril.
Well, I think there are a lot of things like Hank Steinbrenner, just full stop, and pretty much everybody on the Yankees showing up to camp overweight, seems like, that aren't Cashman's fault, you know. But yeah, the Soriano press conference definitely had kind of a falling down quality about it. Yeah. It was definitely a little bit of a snappage moment there. You know, when you've been beaten down like he has been by the original boss, you know, maybe nothing else anyone can do to you registers after that guy's gone, you know. Crap. Or you just like, make my day. And I worked for George Steinbrenner for, you know, 10 years or whatever it's been. You know, and maybe Hank's a joke, you know? I mean, it sounds like Hank doesn't know what he's doing, and Cashman's just off the reservation because he can be, you know?
Yeah. Denton, you assume he's you're counting down the days till he's in a straitjacket, right?
You know, half of me thinks that. The other half wonders if he just knows he's not coming back and this is how he shoves it up their ass on his way out. I don't get the guy. I mean, some of these moves they made this offseason, they're terrible. They're not good moves, and you know, now you got a little turmoil going on, and how Hank starts talking about people building mansions and stuff, and I don't know. I just see total disarray in New York right now, and as much as I hate to count them out, you know, with their pitching staff what it is, I'm not scared of them right now.
I do have to say that, and I know I'll take a you take beatings for saying these things nowadays, but I think a little piece of my heart, and I'm man enough to say this, a little piece of my heart will just break off and melt away the first time that Johnny Damon and Manny Ramirez are here as members of the Tampa Bay Rays. I've forever been they would call me a Manny apologist. I've never been able to boo the guy. I don't understand why you would boo the guy. You know, certainly I understand people saying things like, you know, talking about how he, you know, oh, he gave up on the team. He was, you know, he's earning all that money. He refused to play. He chucked an old man down the stairs, which I've always argued. That's how you gain cred in my neighborhood growing up. He threw an old man down some stairs. That's just how it was. That's how we rolled. But I will say that that's going to be the most interesting thing for me in the coming year in the AL East, because not a day goes by you don't get a little nostalgia for 2004, and I do miss Manny. I miss the way he left here. I think it was very unfortunate, and it'll be nice to see them, but a little bittersweet as well. Do you have any, Beth, any feelings on those two, or do you give a shit? some people don't give a shit. I'm amazed how some people are just like, whatever.
I mean, I think actually I was going to say about counting the Yankees out, I was going to say don't take your eye off the Rays.
Good point.
Both those guys are getting long in the tooth, but they've got some power hitters for sure in both of them, at least in Manny. You know, and they're both kind of twilight of their careers. I mean, it's weird. It's like they're following in the footsteps of Wade Boggs. But, you know, they... I think the Rays are still a wilier team. I think they still have a lot of younger guys. You know, the Yankees are old, or they're fat, or they're overpaid, or they're just, you know, a mess. But the Rays could be sleepers.
You just described me, by the way, too. Thank you very much. Except for the overpaid part. Lastly, just to be not to jinx anything, we don't like to jinx things on the cusp of a new season full of promise. But just for laughs, I'll ask each of you to predict the first player of the Red Sox you think is going on the DL. Denton, who do you think?
Do I really have to answer this? I've got the over under for JD Drew at 115 games. I'm taking the under, so
I knew somebody was going to crap on poor JD. I knew
it has to be me. His contract can't end soon enough.
I've always said that JD. I still think that if 2004 had never happened, and we had this argument in the last podcast, if 2004 never happened, and all we had was the 2007 World Series, then you'd be speaking of J.D. Drew in the same hushed tones you speak of Dave Roberts. There'd be petitions for statues and J.D. Drew Day and J.D. Drew costumes and things like that. I mean, it gets overshadowed because 2004 was so immense, and as you pointed out, it was the Yankees and all that in the ALCS, but that grand slam in the ALCS in 2007 by J.D. Drew. That to me, I mean, he could do no wrong after that. I don't care how much they're paying him.
First inning? Yeah,
it ain't my money. It ain't my money they're paying him. Beth, what do you think on the, as morbid as it is, who do you think is the first one on the DL for
the
Sox?
I'm just, like, getting ready to be struck by lightning any second here. But, you know, I actually think, I do wonder, I guess. I'm not going to say I'm placing a bet, but I wonder if it might be Adrian Gonzalez, because he's been, you know, out there talking about how he's going to get back for opening day, and, you know, he's absolutely going to be out there, and I believe he probably will actually be there for the big day, but it wouldn't surprise me, you know, to see him kind of show up for that high visibility moment so nobody starts, you know, heading for the Tobin Bridge in April.
Beth, if that ever happens, man, you're going to have the natives with the torches and the pitchforks hunting you down for saying that.
Right, and then, you know, but I could see, you know, him falling back again a little bit early on in the season, maybe when it's not, you know, so much a, not such a bright spotlight, you know, because, you know, he is recovering from shoulder surgery and he's only just started to swing a bat.
Right.
You know, and he's promising he's going to be back for opening day. And it's like, you know, good luck, buddy. You got a month.
Yeah.
And he'll probably be there, but if he has to pull back a little bit, I think that's the best thing for him, you know.
You're right. That's a good point. I remember the great debut of Coco Crisp. We were all so anxious to see him play because he seemed like a fun guy. And then, of course, he was here. And then I think we saw him, what, two games in the whole spring. He broke his fingers in the first week of the season or something like that.
Yeah, he broke his finger on a completely unnecessary head first slide in the third base, you know. But I don't know. I was mad at him about that, actually. My friend Ryan was like, throw a little mustard on that hot dog. Walking back to the dugout, because I think he was out, too.
Just to add insult, and he probably lost his jockstrap, just a complete perfect storm of horrible things.
But him dodging that punch when he charged the mound, that's unforgettable. That was great.
Actually, him smashing the hell out of his knee to make the final catch in the 07 ALCS is my favorite Coco moment.
Yeah,
He'd been cooling his heels on the bench the whole game. They put him in for the last two outs. It would be so easy for anybody to just be like, F you, you know?
Yep.
And he was still heads up. He still made that catch, you know?
That was a good moment. We've just come up with two great Coco moments, you know? Perhaps I was wrong to diss his introduction to the team, if you will. I think for myself, as far as the DL goes, is I'm going to go with Daisuke Matsuzaka. But I think it's going to be a wink-wink, one of those things where he gets stuffed in a gym bag by Josh Beckett and thrown on a banana boat somewhere, and that's the last we ever see of him. It is amazing to think that we almost went to war with Japan for this guy just a few years ago, and he's gone from being, you know, I think he was dubbed the greatest pitcher who ever lived to being a somewhat serviceable, basically, fifth starter. But we'll take whatever we can get out of him at this point.
Well, you know, if it's going to be like that, it could be Beckett, too, after he developed some bad mechanics from sore shoulder doing that.
Yeah. You know? This might have been a bad question to bring up. Let's not even talk about the deal. After last year, was such a joke. It's almost like, you know, if we can just have that, that's always the feeling of, you know, Carl Crawford comes running on an opening day and trips, and, you know, it's the last you see of him. So it's, you never know. You never like to make fun of someone's, livelihood being threatened by injury. But, man, after last year, I think we need a break. Let's hope that the only person who goes on the DL this year is, I don't know, maybe Terry Francona hurts a toe or something like that, and he has to take a few days off. If that's the worst we have to deal with in 2011, I think we'll be in good shape.
I think we're owed some players. If somebody like Adrian Beltre could knee somebody else's outfielder in the ribs this year, maybe that would even things up.
Exactly. So that's some of the most horrific Red Sox injuries have been ones brought on. I'll never forget Johnny Damon. Was it Damon? Who was it he ran into? Damian Jackson?
Yes.
That horrific, it was in the 2003 ALCS, or it might have been the ALDS. Yeah. It was, oof! You know, that was something where, you know, you saw the two of them collide and you heard it. That's always bad when you hear it. You know, when I'm sitting there on TV and I'm like, okay, I know they don't have microphones, like, wedged in the grass of center field, but I heard that. Oh, all right. Injuries, superstitions, Beth's obsession with Beckett. Any other horrible things we can? Anything else we can do to drive a stake in the heart of 2011 before it even starts?
Gyro ball, fact or fiction? Remember that scandal?
Only John Henry's wife knows for sure.
Oh.
Well, I had to bring it down. Now that I've brought it to a crashing halt. I think we'll wrap things up right now. This has been a really good podcast, though. I certainly appreciate everyone's time. Just to recap, obviously you've got myself and Denton, and we thank Beth from Cursed to First. That's cursedtofirst.com. When did you just get that domain name? You didn't have that for the longest time. Is that new?
Yeah, no, it's new. It's new. I finally stepped boldly into the 20th century and got myself a URL shorter than, you know, 500 characters. So.
Just as blogs become passe, everyone knows the new things is hovercrafts. You know, writing. We're moving from the blog just to strictly semaphore. That's what we're going to be doing. It'll be Denton and I on a roof with flags every morning, basically. And there you have it. Well, Beth, thank you very much for your time. We greatly appreciate you stopping in and calling in and giving us your insight. And
thanks,
as we said again, please check out Curse 2 First. Beth was actually, and you actually had Peter Gammons responding to your tweet about Josh Beckett today.
Here we go with me and Beckett again.
Well, it's better than Beckett's lawyer responding to your tweet,
that's
so I guess.
True, that's true. That'll be next, right? But oh my God, this is so bad. This is like you with a Amelie Benjamin. Did you ever hear from her people?
No, but Heidi Watney did respond to a tweet a week ago, so I basically just came out of detox like the other day because of that, so I can only imagine.
Yeah, having your existence acknowledged by Gammons, it's like, does anybody want to touch me? It was just great. I mean, just... you know, he was telling me, because I was amazed at just how great an interview it was with Beckett, because we're used to him dropping F-bombs in live press conferences, and, you know, I'll still never forget that headline on your post about how he'll tear your still beating heart out of your chest. What after Shelly Duncan? I mean, that was, you know, but that's how we're used to seeing him.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, he's talking like a professor all of a sudden. You know, on this interview with Gammons, and I couldn't believe the vocabulary that was coming out of his mouth that we don't normally hear. And, you know, it just seemed like Gammons really drew him out. So that's all I was trying to say, but, you know,
what Gammons happens when you marry a rocket scientist or whatever the hell she is?
I've heard that theory, actually, already. You know, like that might have done it. but
he'll still be an animal when he gets on the field. Don't worry.
I hope so.
I always got the same impression from Gabe Kapler, who was a great guy, but because he was just so big and physically imposing and into the weightlifting and all that, you expected whenever they interviewed him, you almost expected that guy from the Planet Fit. I lift things up and put them down. You know, you almost expected that. But then whenever he talked, he was very, you know, clean and lucid and very gregarious, and he had a pretty good, yeah, it's a horrible thing to say, but a pretty good vocabulary for a pro ball player.
So well.
And here, watching that Beckett interview today, I almost said, I'm like, have they got like a pot of tea brewing there? Is there like a little pile of nice biscuits between them? Because he was amazingly domesticated. It was, maybe it could be the marriage thing, you know?
Yeah, or they shot him with a rhino dart.
Well, thank you very much for listening. Hopefully folks are still have legged it out till the very end. But once again, thanks to Beth from Curse to First. That's Beth. My name is Red. His name is Denton. Thank you for joining us, and we will see you next time.